are not controlled by the United States are going through the culture, through the color revolutions. Exactly. The Americans are trying to undermine political stability in those countries which they do not have control. They introduce various methods for chaotization of those countries. They provoke wars between countries. The main idea of them was to provoke the war between Russia and China. Fortunately, it didn't happen. Now the Russia and China have strategic partnership. And because the China is too large now, and American lose the economic competition with China, they're trying now to press Russia, to undermine Russia, to destroy Russia, in order to improve its position in the world by means of controlling the Russia natural resources and to prevent the growth of China. So American plan today has three stages. The first one, to destroy Russia, because, you know, the Russophobia is one of the long-term, have deep roots in Anglo-Saxon geopolitics.
Exactly.
The whole geopolitics theory of the 19th century, designed by the English and Germans, was the some quasi-science how to destroy the Russian Empire. It was the main headache of the Western geopoliticians to find methods how to destroy the Russian Empire. And the Ukrainian crisis, the war today in Ukraine, happened according to the recommendations of their geopolitical theory, starting from Bismarck and then following with Brzezinski. They stressed a lot of times that in order to destroy Russia, first of all, you have to get away Ukraine from Russia, because the formula of Brzezinski was that Russia without Ukraine couldn't be the superpower. And all this Russophobia, which was have deep roots in the Anglo-Saxon geopolitics, now played a key role. Why the United States use Russia as the main goal to maintain the world hegemony. And Ukrainian provocation was prepared on the systemic basis during the 20 years, especially the last 8 years. They trying to control Ukraine. As you know, they organized the coup d'etat in Ukraine. The Ukraine during the last 8 years do not have independent government. This territory is totally controlled by the CIA and other American and British organizations. And the first stage for them is of this hybrid war. In fact, hybrid war began with the sanctions against Russia in 2014. And then the second stage was the economic war with China, where the American used the same methods as the British Empire used in the 30s, when British Empire prevented the access of American goods to their empire in order to get more compatible position in comparison with the United States. Now the United States did the same. They launched the trade war with China in order to maintain their markets and in order to limit the growth of China, but they failed in this war. Nowadays, they used sanctions against Russia. They intervened, in fact, in Russia military and cultural space. They are trying to destroy Russia with various information technologies and trying to use to provoke the war in Ukraine in order to undermine the Russian government. They want to chaotize Russia. And second, they want to destroy Iran. They do this, they're trying to do this permanently during the last 20 years. And their final goal is China.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Leaders meeting with group of academic elites. On Wednesday, 19th of October 2022, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyidali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of highly talented young scientists and outstanding academics of Iran. In this program, we discuss the leader's speech and points of view expressed at this meeting. Please stay with us. On Wednesday, 19th of October, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyidali Khamenei, had a meeting with hundreds of highly talented young scientists and academic elites. It should be noted that before the triumph of the Islamic Revolution, there were no outstanding world-class Iranian scientists and academics. But in 2016, according to the well-respected Web of Science website, there were 208 outstanding Iranian scientists and academics who were among the top 1% of world scientists. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, who has given his full backing to the growth of young scientific talent in Iran, having played a central role in establishment of various scientific and research institutions in the country, expressed his joy and gratitude that such a meeting has been arranged. The leader said, "I'm deeply, deeply thankful of Almighty God for allowing this joyful, lively and hope-inspiring meeting to take place once again, now that the coronavirus problem has been largely resolved. Indeed, the presence of you young people, especially young talented academics, generates hope. Your presence, wherever that may be, creates hope, and that is very important." The leader added, "I want to mention two or three points about who the elites are and what they do, and what do we expect from the country's academic elite. Regarding the scientific elite, and elite in general, first of all, we must know, I strongly believe that we should all know this, the scientific elite are one of the country's most precious assets. Yes, the country's natural resources are important. Their geographical location and climatic conditions are also very important. All of these are important, but the existence of these scientific elites is one of the country's most important assets. The elite should be considered a great asset. Once we consider them a great asset, that is when we will try to produce more of them and will consider it harmful to lose them. We will treat them with benevolence. Once we understand that they are a great and important asset for the country, our behaviour towards them will be shaped accordingly. In further remarks, the leader of the Islamic Revolution added, "The scientific elite, and basically the universities, are among the pillars of progress for this country. That is, universities are one of the most important pillars for the country's progress, and the main constituents of the universities are the scientific elite, the highly talented young scientists. The reason you see that, on different occasions, not just yesterday or the day before, attempts have been made to shut down universities or cancel classes so that students and professors won't go to classes is due to the fact that universities play a fundamental role in Iran's progress." Ayatollah Khamenei poignantly added, "I say this forthrightly and with courage. There is no doubt about it. With the triumph of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the needed infrastructure and background for development and growth of highly talented and outstanding young academics and scientists became available." In further remarks, the leader said, "Those who oppose the Islamic Republic cannot bear to see Iran progressing in science and technology and often deny Iran's scientific and technological advancement by prevarication, lies, and attempting to portray everything upside down." Ayatollah Khamenei added, "Universities are one of the greatest obstacles that stand in the way of the arrogant powers. We need to realize that the goal of the world's aggressors is to dominate. By what means? One day they use weapons, another day they use deception, and the next day they use science. They also dominate using science. Universities prevent their domination. This means that if you can raise the scientific status of the country, you are creating a real impediment, a real barrier to domination by the enemy. So that's another important point about academic elite and universities." In further remarks, the leader said, "Another point to note is that one element in creating the academic elite is their natural talent, good thought, good mind, good brain, which are all divine gifts. This is not someone's doing, rather it is God-given. Now, why God has given these people this talent is a whole different topic for discussion. The Almighty God has blessed this academic elite of ours with a powerful brain, a good mind, preparedness and alertness, and that's one element. The second element that makes someone an academic elite is their endeavour, their efforts and hard work. Otherwise, there are plenty of people who have this God-given gift, but they don't work, they don't put in any effort, and they don't strive, and they don't get anywhere. They have no self-growth, and they don't help the country either. We have had plenty of these people, we'll still have them, and there were even more of them in the past. So the second element that is required for creating an academic elite is related to their effort and perseverance." Turning to flourishing and spreading of universities in Iran, the leader said, "Which part of the country have you seen where there isn't a university?" Now, some complain that universities have been established in some places without the necessary facilities. Very well, so the motivation to establish a university was there. That's very important. There are universities all over the country. The universities in some remote cities are outstanding. A person can see this. They have very good lecturers, distinguished professors lecturing at universities in certain remote cities. We know some of them. So that is about spread of universities. And there are the academics. The number of academics, both students and professors, has increased. The number of students in the country, now I have mentioned these statistics many times before, but I don't remember it exactly right now. The sources weren't available to me when I was writing down these notes. There has been a 25-fold increase in the number of students in the Islamic Republic of Iran, a 25-fold increase compared to pre-revolutionary levels is very high. Lecturers in the first years after the revolution, around 1980 or 1981, when I was discussing issues related to universities, there were about 5,000 faculty members in the country as a whole. Today, there are well over 100,000 faculty members. There are over 100,000 faculty members. The country's population has more than doubled in this period of time. But the increase in faculty members has been astounding 20-fold. These are important matters. These statistics speak for themselves. And this clearly shows what the Islamic Revolution has accomplished. There is, of course, a multitude of research institutes in the country, think tanks and research institutes. They're abundant in many parts of the country. The scientific development we're seeing in the country is something that is really valuable. It is part of the groundwork that is needed for nurturing the elite, the highly talented young scientists and engineers. We should truly appreciate the academics. Our academics have not allowed the country to become dependent on the West. Because when a country has universities but no professors, one of the things that comes to mind is to get professors from outside of the country. But our academics did not allow this to happen. They trained people to become professors instead. Around 90% of Iranian professors today have come from the generation that was trained by our own university professors. They worked hard and put in the effort. The Islamic Republic wanted to expand its universities and make them powerful, and thankfully this has happened today. Universities also took advantage of this historical opportunity and developed themselves. And this is one issue. Another issue is that it is not an exaggeration when I say that the academic elites of the country have become a source of honour for the Islamic Republic of Iran. You are the young generation of elites. There were many elites before you, the generations before you, who brought honour to this country during the past 40 years. Whatever issue our scientists encountered and focused on, they did something that garnered admiration within the world's scientific community. For example, the research and achievements of Royan Research Institute, not just regarding stem cell research, but also in cloning of live animals. This was something rare in the world, but it happened here in the Islamic Republic. I saw those living animals myself. I'm not narrating from others. I went and saw the living animals that had been cloned and created, and there wasn't just one, there were quite a few of them. We have seen these things happen. It was not a small task. May God's mercy be upon the soul of Professor Kazemi Ashtiani, and he was the one who laid the foundation for this, and then our brothers, who are there now, pursued it and have reached this stage now. That's one example. Advancements in biochemistry and achieving a UNESCO chair in biochemistry, they have admitted it themselves. You know that in these international chairs, one of the basic tasks of the enemy is to interfere, infiltrate, and prevent Iran from getting a seat and becoming a member state. Despite this, our outstanding scientists and elites have achieved this victory. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei continued by saying, "Another example is that we've sent satellites into space. Only a few countries have done this. Not all countries have this technology. A lot of countries have satellites in space, but they are incapable of launching the satellites themselves. There are only a few countries that have launched satellites into space. Of course, we are behind, but we launched these satellites. We were able to do it. Our scientists concentrated on this, and now one of our brothers here mentioned that these things have been achieved in the field of space and aerospace research. For example, building a humanoid robot at Tehran University is also very important and a great achievement. Fundamental achievements in the nuclear industry, the issue of peaceful nuclear technology, has a long story. There is a lot to be said in this regard, but our time is limited. We have gained access to fundamental issues in nuclear industry. We are not seeking weapons or bombs or anything like that, but this industry itself has many benefits, and we were able to gain access to peaceful civilian nuclear technology." Well, these are the things that the Iranian academic elite have accomplished. These things are truly a source of honor for the country. Another example is the production of complex vaccines, including the COVID-19 vaccine and the like. There are many examples, that's another point, that the Iranian elite and scientists have been able to provide the country with honour. I'm saying these things because I want you all, the academic elite, the highly young, talented elite, to appreciate yourselves. I want those sitting outside to appreciate you. I personally have great appreciation for you, and I hope that we will be able to help you in the future. As for the third element, I already spoke about two other elements. This third element now, that makes you an academic elite, that makes you become an elite, is the element of divine guidance and assistance from the Almighty. Without a doubt, you need God to pave the way for you and provide you with divine guidance in order to become, to be considered an elite. Merely having talent and using this talent doesn't make someone into an academic elite. Another point is that our academic elite should be shown bright horizons. Some people make our elite lose hope and paint a dark future for them. That is certainly not the case. The horizon for young, highly talented Iranian scientists and engineers is very bright indeed. This should be known by all of you, and you should all be encouraged. Professors, higher education managers and media, whether it be the state media or the press, and owners of knowledge-based industries and companies, as some of you have also mentioned, should create an encouraging atmosphere for the academic elite. Today, discouraging the elite, making them lose their hope in the future, is, in my opinion, the enemy's soft war strategy against the Islamic Republic. The enemy is striving to show a bleak future for our elite. Now, I should also add that the country does have its weak points. I'm not denying this. There is not only a few, but many weak points. However, we need to see the strengths alongside the weaknesses. The enemy strives to magnify the weaknesses and cover up our strengths, and we should not help the enemy in this regard. And this is the last thing that I would like to speak about. I will talk about this horizon and how we can correct it. Since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution, the West has waged a propaganda campaign against Iran. in which they claim that the Islamic Republic is declining. They would say it was declining from the very first days. Sometimes they would say that the Islamic Republic will be finished in 2 months' time, or in 1 year's time, or in 5 years from now, and they would set specific dates. Some people inside the country also promote these claims, either out of neglect or with malevolent intentions. After the founder of the Islamic Republic, the late Imam Khomeini, passed away in 1989, there were a number of people, among whom there were some well-regarded and experienced individuals, who made declarations about how the government is on the edge of an abyss. They tried to imply that the government would collapse any day now. That was back in 1989. In 2003, a number of parliamentarians wrote a letter to me. It was really an unfair letter. Very unfair. They said some things and they asked some questions that they had to answer themselves. Because both the parliament and the government at the time were in their hands. They needed to answer those questions, but they were demanding answers from me. In summary, the letter stated that you need to surrender, otherwise you'll be finished. That was back in 2003. We did not surrender, of course. We stood up to them, and God willing, we shall continue to do the same. Our enemies have kept doing this repeatedly. The thing that we should look at this context is to see what our analysis of the situation is. Let's conduct a proper analysis. There are two analytical systems that exist. One analytical system believes that standing up to the widespread global norms is useless and there's no point in doing it. They say that there are international norms and governments who have formed and have gained power based on these norms. The powerful and wealthy United States has been shaped according to these norms. Europe is the same. Other countries are the same. Don't waste your time standing up to these norms. You'll be destroyed. That's one kind of analysis. The second type of analysis is more realistic. This type of analysis sees the reality, not just the good facts, but the bad facts as well. I have never denied the weaknesses. In the meetings that I have with officials, in the Ramadan gatherings, I point out the weaknesses more than anything else, and I do so much more in our private meetings. We pay attention to the weaknesses. It's not that we do not notice them. I have said many times before that we are behind. There is no doubt in that. But on the other hand, we started a rapid movement from the end of the line, and now we are almost at the front of science and technology. And this is an excellent and an inspiring fact. Look at where the Islamic Republic was 40 years ago and where it is now today. Look at where it was 20 years ago and where it is now today. After 4 decades, we can understand which of these two analyses has been realistic.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Palestinian movement Hamas has restored relations with the Syrian government after holding a historic meeting with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The Syrian president also met with Palestinian factions. This is the first such visit by Hamas officials to the Syrian capital since the year 2012. Hamas said the movement will continue to build and develop solid relations with the Syrian Arab Republic, considering that this decision serves the nation and its just causes, with the cause of Palestine at its core. Yet the important question is, why the resumption of ties at this time? For starters, the resumption of relations between Hamas and Damascus would strengthen the axis of resistance in West Asia. Hamas will now cement its role within the axis of resistance against its enemy, Israel. This may impact the way each acts against the other, especially militarily. This reconciliation appears to have rattled the U.S. cage, which was quick to denounce the move. It said the Assad regime's outreach to this terrorist organization only reinforces its isolation. It also harms the interests of the Palestinian people. But Hamas's move formalizes a rapprochement that has been underway for some time and comes amid fundamental shifts in West Asia. For example, Turkey is considering a rapprochement with Assad. The UAE has already done the same. Also, Jordan's King Abdullah II has showed overtures. The United Arab Emirates and Bahrain have gone ahead and reopened their embassies in Damascus. This is while senior officials in several Arab states are pressing to reinstate Syria's membership of the Arab League. Another important development has taken place that cannot go unnoticed. Palestinian factions signed a reconciliation agreement in Algeria, in which Hamas, Fatah, and 12 other Palestinian groups agreed to hold legislative and presidential elections within 1 year. In the Algiers meeting, Ismail Haniyeh said, "This is a historical moment through which we see Al-Quds." He thanked the Algerian president Abdelmadjid Tebboune for his country's efforts in sponsoring the talks. But what did he mean exactly? How would this reconciliation enable Palestinians to see Al-Quds? Yet the timing of these two events, the Algiers reconciliation of Palestinian factions, then Hamas's trip to Syria, gives the impression that there are serious diplomatic moves being made between Palestinian factions. Another development, which is another piece to this puzzle, is the head of Hamas's political bureau chief, Ismail Haniyeh, visiting Moscow recently and holding high-level political talks with Russian officials, including the foreign minister Sergei Lavrov. This puts the spotlight on Russia's role here. Russia is signaling how it wants to play a more constructive role when it comes to the West Asia region, especially when it comes to Palestinians. This couldn't be any clearer than the stance that the PA President Mahmoud Abbas took when it came to Russia, which was relayed during the SICA meeting that was held recently. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, who met with the Russian President Vladimir Putin, relayed to him his mistrust of the U.S. in resolving the conflict with Israel, expressing an appreciation for Russia's role. He voiced his support for the Mideast quartet of international mediators, namely Russia, the U.S., the United Nations, and the European Union, but said the U.S. could not be left a free hand to act alone. He said, "We don't trust America, and you know our position. We don't trust it, we don't rely on it, and under no circumstances can we accept that America is the sole party in resolving a problem." Maybe that is why the U.S. is raising the alarm over the reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas. Now that they are on one page, they can act with one voice against Israel and the U.S. And the U.S. reaction to this is very telling when it says that it will take this out against Palestinians, instead of taking a diplomatic approach towards the two groups reconciling, since they can speak with one voice for the Palestinians. This may mean that there will be more pressure and violations by Israel against the Palestinians with full U.S. support.
The Twitter account of UN Human Rights Council addressed the report published by the three-member commission and shared the link to it. The title of the report very clearly addresses the occupation to be unlawful under international law with zero ambiguity. The report states the reason for the conclusion to be the permanence of the occupation as well as Israel's de facto annexation policies. Navi Pillai, chair of the commission, stated, "Recent statements by the Secretary General and numerous member states have clearly indicated that any attempt at unilateral annexation of a state's territory by another is a violation of international law and is null and void. 143 member states, including Israel, last week voted in favor of a General Assembly resolution reaffirming this." The chair also further added, "Unless universally applied, including to the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, this core principle of the United Nations Charter will become meaningless." The 28-page report published by Navanethem Pillai, Milun Kothari, and Christopher Sidoti highlights the sustenance and the advancement of the settlement enterprise, and the continuous expansion over the past couple of years that resulted in many Palestinian families to be forced out of their homes only for foreigners who've never been to the land to occupy their homes.
Yaakov, you know this is not your house.
Yes, but if I go, you don't go back. So what's the problem? What are you yelling at me? I didn't do this.
But you're
easy to yell at me, but I didn't do this.
Yeah, you are stealing my house.
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going
to
steal it.
No one is allowed to steal it, Yammi.
Statements by Israeli officials that showed their intention to maintain permanent control over the expanding settlements were also noted in the reports and were part of the reason why the occupation was declared unlawful. Chair of the commission also recognized the direct and indirect transferring of Israelis into the settlements as a plan to ensure permanent Israeli control in the West Bank. The Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including Al-Quds and in Israel. That is the name that the UN gave to the commission in May of 2021 when the UN Human Rights Council held a special session on the grave human rights situation in the Occupied Palestinian Territory. During the session, the UNHRC decided to establish an urgent international commission of inquiry to investigate alleged human rights violations in the occupied Palestinian territories at the hands of Israel. The recent report is the culmination of what the three-member council has found during the past year and a half in what seems to be an uncharacteristically direct accusation of Israeli human rights violation and breaking of international law. Let's take a quick look at some of the bullet points mentioned in the report. An allusion to the core principles of the UN on annexation, which Israel seems to have also agreed to, even though it has violated it. The existence of a settlement enterprise and the efforts to make settlement permanent, violating the rights of Palestinians who were forced to leave as settlers took their homes by force. Israelis' exploitation of land and natural resources, the restrictive urban planning and zoning policies that seize Palestinian construction as an impediment to settlements that result in frequent confiscation of land, demolition of homes, and eventually displacement. The silent harm and psychological trauma resulting from erosion of economic, social, and cultural rights of Palestinians in a coercive environment that fragments the Palestinian society. The necessity of international action as Israeli government's actions are seen by the Commission as criminal, particularly its direct and indirect transfer of civilian population into occupied and annexed territories. The report seems to be a step in the right direction for the UN to fulfill its sole responsibility of standing up for human rights violations globally. But whether or not the criminal accusations towards Israel will lead to an international court of justice investigation and trial remains to be seen, especially when Israel has the unwavering support of the US.
Iran has doubled down on its earlier stance that it has not supplied weapons to Russia to be used against Ukraine. Foreign ministry officials say those claims are untrue and based on false information. Tehran says the accusations are part of a propaganda campaign by the West to stoke tensions with Iran. The accusations against Iran have been leveled by Ukraine and its Western backers. They say Russia has been using Iranian-made drones to strike Ukrainian cities in recent weeks. The Kremlin has also roundly denied the accusation, saying it's using Russia-made weapons in its strikes. Also, some Western media outlets have cited U.S. security officials as saying that more Iranian drones as well as missiles are to be shipped to Russia. But the Pentagon says it cannot confirm those reports. However, it says it will take steps to make the sale of Iranian drones harder. Ukraine has also threatened to cut diplomatic ties with Iran. But Tehran says it holds a neutral stance and believes dialogue is the best way to end the war. Iran has invariably stressed the need for respect for various countries' sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, including Ukraine, based on the principles of the United Nations Charter.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has taken a clear and consistent position on the situation in Ukraine, which has been pronounced since the start of the conflict. The Islamic Republic of Iran has always emphasized that all UN members must fully respect the purpose and principles enshrined in the United Nations Charter as well as applicable international law.
The accusations against Iran come amid intensifying tensions at war fronts in Ukraine. Citizens and pro-Russian officials are evacuating from the main city in Kherson region just as Ukrainian forces are pushing to take back the area from Russia. Over 60,000 people will be evacuated within the next 6 days. The anti-Iran claims first emerged in July. Back then, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan alleged that Washington had received, quote, information indicating that Iran was preparing to provide Russia with up to several hundred unmanned aerial vehicles, including weapons-capable UAVs, on an expedited timeline. Flying at low altitude, these unmanned aircraft can evade traditional air defense systems before dive bombing their targets. The distinctive delta wing design of the drones has led Ukrainian and Western officials to claim that they are Iranian Shahed 136 UAVs. Russia's use of the so-called kamikaze drones has sparked panic in Ukraine. The United States, Britain and France were planning to raise the claim during a closed-door UN Security Council meeting. They accuse Iran of violating a UN Security Council resolution that had placed an arms embargo on Iran. The arms embargo expired in 2020, despite the efforts of former US President Donald Trump to renew it.
Iran categorically rejected unfounded and unsubstantiated claims that Iran has transferred UAVs for the use of the conflict in Ukraine. It is recently disappointing that to pursue their political agenda, these states are trying to launch a disinformation campaign against Iran.
So, dear colleagues, today we have observed another round of the disinformation campaign from the Security Council by the Western delegations, as they raised in the Council the issue of the UAVs allegedly used by Russia in Ukraine. The aim of our Western colleagues is clear. They attempt to hit two targets at once, inventing an artificial pretext to put pressure on Russia and on Iran.
The accusations come amid continued NATO military support for Ukraine. The West is now under fire for fanning the flames of war by sending more and more military hardware there. It's now believed that the accusations made against Iran are part of a larger media campaign against the Islamic Republic. The West, led by the United States, were trying to pressurize Iran by supporting the rioters in Iran during the recent tensions. They imposed a series of sanctions on Iranian officials over human rights allegations. However, they failed to dictate their will on Iran.
France is facing protests over the cost of living crisis fueled by soaring inflation. Police have clashed with the protesters, venting anger in the capital, Paris. Protesters were met with police brutality. Police used batons to disperse the protesters, who were throwing rocks at security forces. There are calls by trade unions for a nationwide transport strike. Unions now say it is time to expand the industrial action at oil refineries to other sectors. Protesters and strikers say they need pay rise to cope with the soaring cost of living. France is now experiencing inflation at 6.2%. That is the highest rate in decades. Striking workers are demanding higher wages from the profits of energy companies amid high oil and gas prices. Protesters have demanded emergency measures against high prices, including freezes in the cost of energy. The industrial action has taken offline more than 60% of France's refining capacity. Macron's government is also on the defensive in Parliament, where it has lost its majority in legislative elections in June. It is much more difficult for his centrist alliance to implement his agenda against strengthened opponents. France is not the only country in Europe that is facing protests. European countries are facing more strikes and protests due to high energy prices and the mounting cost of living. The UK economy shrank by 0.3% in August. It experienced a 10.2% inflation rate in September, which was the highest in 40 years. The latest data shows that inflation rose on average to 10.9% across the European Union. Europe faces a very difficult economic climate if the current energy crisis worsens, with winter temperatures likely to be a decisive factor.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The energy crisis in UK is finally showing up its true face, with the government expected to make further spending cuts. According to The Observer, schools in England are struggling to pay their electricity and heating bills, and 90% of them will run out of money next year. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote, schools in England are struggling to pay their electricity and heating bills, and 90% of them will run out of money next year, the Observer claimed recently. With the cost of living crisis already forcing some school children to go hungry, the government plans to cut spending across all departments. The National Association of Head Teachers told the newspaper that 50% of their schools will be in deficit this year, with the figure rising to 90% by next September. Power and heating bills at some schools have risen from £26,000 a year to £89,000, the report has stated. On top of this increase, schools are having to fund a 5% teachers' pay rise announced this summer. Chancellor Jeremy Hunt is expected to announce spending cuts to all departments, including education, at the end of the month. Several school trusts told the newspaper that they are eating into their cash reserves to keep their buildings heated and their teachers paid. However, there comes a point where we simply run out of money, said Gary Ratcliffe, whose trust runs three primary schools in Kent. Furthermore, Ratcliffe said he has seen an increase in the number of families unable to pay their own bills or feed their children. Families who have never required support before are coming to us, he said. There is a great sense of shame for the dad who works every hour he can, but still has to walk into school and ask for help. A survey released last week by chefs in schools found that 83% of teachers reported children coming to school hungry because their parents were unable to afford food. Nearly a quarter said that children at their schools skipped lunch due to poverty. Energy costs and inflation, which had been creeping upward since the end of the COVID-19 pandemic, have skyrocketed since the UK decided to cut itself off from Russian fossil fuels. Outgoing Prime Minister Liz Truss exacerbated the economic crisis with a disastrous mini-budget last month that crashed the British pound, an attempt to blame Britain's economic woes on Russian President Vladimir Putin. Responding to the Observer's latest report, a Department of Education spokesperson took a similar tack, blaming the cost pressures on schools on international events and promising to offset the cost via an energy relief scheme. Guardian wrote, 9 out of 10 schools in England will have run out of money by the next school year as the enormous burden of increased energy and salary bills takes its toll, the Observer can reveal. Early data from the National Association of Head Teachers, results of a survey of its members are due later this month, shows that 50% of heads say their school will be in deficit this year, with almost all expecting to be in the red by next September, when there is a run out. This comes as Jeremy Hunt has made clear that all departments, including education, will be expected to make cuts as part of the government's debt reduction plan to be announced on October 31st. Head teachers and academy leaders are warning that further spending cuts will push many schools and academy trusts over the cliff and result in most schools having to lose essential teaching and support staff. There are no easy fixes left, said Paul Whitman, General Secretary of the NAHT, adding, schools are cut to the bone. This will mean cutting teaching hours, teaching assistants, and teachers. Steve Chalk, whose Oasis Foundation runs 52 academies in England, said, At this burn rate, in under 3 years, we will be bankrupt. No one is in a position to keep going for very long eating their reserves. Chalk said electricity and gas costs for schools in his chain had rocketed from £26,000 a year to £89,000, even with the 6 month energy price cap. The foundation is also having to find an extra £4.5 million for the teachers' pay rise, which was announced this summer after school budgets had been set. The rise, which at 5% for most teachers remains significantly below inflation, is seen as crucial but has left the schools floundering because it came with no new funding. Chalk said he was absolutely frustrated that the government was planning further cuts. Any government that neglects the welfare and education of its children had better be saving up for its future mental health and benefits bills and investing in the justice system, he added. A spokesperson for the Department for Education said, "We understand that the schools are facing cost pressures due to international events driving up energy prices." She added that as well as the energy relief scheme, the schools would receive £53.8 billion in core funding this year, which includes a cash increase of £4 billion. But Johnny Otelli, CEO of the Education Alliance Academy Trust, which runs 7 schools in Hull and East Yorkshire, said, "I know a CEO of a large successful trust who says that after the unfunded teacher pay rises, they won't be going concerned next year unless there is extra funding." Otley's trust is using reserves to manage energy, pay and other costs, but he said there comes a point where we simply run out of money. Gary Ratcliffe, CEO of the Galaxy Trust, which runs 3 primary schools in Dartford, Kent, said his trust would be all right this year, but next year will be very tough if there are any more unplanned announcements. He warned that a very significant funding crisis was looming. Ratcliffe's trust is having to spend more on mental health support for children and staff struggling in the cost of living crisis. The school regularly provides food for desperate families as well as helping parents claim extra benefits or challenge rent rises. He said, "Families who have never required support before are coming to us. There is a great sense of shame for the dad who works every hour he can, but it still has to walk into school and ask for help." Lirora Kurdas, chief executive of the Confederation of School Trust, said this year was uncertain, but next was looking really difficult, saying, "Many trusts are having to use some or all of their reserves, but reserves can only be spent once. The government must intervene as a matter of urgency. State education must be funded adequately by the state." Julia Harden, funding specialist at the Association of School and College Leaders Union, said, "Ministers must act now to avoid an impending educational disaster." She said, "These extra costs will necessitate staffing cuts, which will mean larger class sizes, reduced curriculum option, and less support for students."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahan Abbott, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.